Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everybody. Anybody coming for their first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us online for the first time. I'd like to start class by asking you to talk to each other for a couple minutes, just to make some connections and for Against the Stream to be a place where you actually build some community rather than, I feel like there's a failure in meditation communities often to facilitate getting to connect with what we call Sangha, community. Because you come and you meditate in silence and then you listen to a talk. Maybe you ask a question, maybe you don't, and then you leave. But it's easy to not meet people in Buddhist groups. And so for years, I've been trying to help facilitate you meeting each other by giving you a topic to have a brief discussion about. Here's the question for your small groups. What's the difference in your experience between love and attachment? Jesus. Simple question. And so maybe you answer that for each other in saying love feels like this and attachment feels like this. Have you reflect for a moment? What's it feel like when you're attached, clinging? What's clinging feel like? Attachment, clinging. And what's love feel like? same. Also feels like clinging, craving. So there's your, so find, you know, two or three people in the room. Hopefully better to meet people you don't know than to just talk to your friends. It's part of the thing. And at home, I'll open the breakout rooms coming. Welcome back. We'll have a period of meditation and then we'll have some, I'll share some thoughts on attachment and love and awareness. So we'll practice awareness by establishing a meditation posture that is upright but relaxed. Finding a way to sit that feels sustainable, a posture that you can maintain for 30 minutes. And even if we get uncomfortable in the posture, there's something incredibly beneficial from maintaining the posture for the most part, learning to tolerate discomfort. Allowing our eyes to be gently closed, taking a moment to relax, release, soften any places of unnecessary tension in your face, in your chest, shoulders, throat, heart center, belly. Bringing mindfulness to the experience of sitting into the body, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness. The intention to be kind is key. Kindness in the form of accepting our experience just as it is. In the present time experience, there is sound, smell, taste, seeing, even with the eyes closed, the thinking mind's plans, memories, and emotions. And the physical body's sensations and emotions felt in the body. For the first few minutes, it's often useful to gather the attention by choosing one thing to pay attention to. Most often the instruction is to begin with mindfulness of the breath. Let everything else recede to the background and bring the sensations the breath creates to the foreground as the focus of this kind awareness. Mindfulness of the breath. The Buddha's instructions were straightforward and simple. He said something like, breathing in, know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, know that you're breathing out. So you may, if you're newer to practice, you may find it useful to note a silent internal label in the mind that notes in and out with each breath. We're trying to place more awareness on the sensations the breath is creating than on the note. We had this short discussion about love, how that feels versus attachment and how that feels. Invite you in your sitting meditation tonight to bring an attitude of love towards yourself, towards your body, towards your mind. Receiving the breath in loving awareness. Even if you can't quite do it yet, even if you're not sure what that means, just the intention, loving awareness. when the attention, the awareness drifts into thinking about the future or the past, just acknowledge that that's what's happening, planning, reminiscing, remembering, resenting. Perhaps noting it, thinking again, and then choosing with this kind intention, loving awareness, choosing to return to the body, sitting, breathing here and now, disengaging from the contents of the thinking mind, returning to the presence of the breathing body. awareness of what's happening with an attitude of kindness and acceptance, even when the mind is thinking and we're involved in some plans or memories. Non-judgmental friendliness is just what the mind does. It plans, it worries, it rehearses, it replays, remembers. Key part of Buddhist meditation is developing an attitude of friendliness and kindness and a loving awareness of the mind's tendencies, not trying to stop it or judge it or but to see it clearly. This is just what the mind does. And that we do have some choice of how we respond and what we pay attention to. So you can choose to come back to the body, the breath awareness, or you can open. The Buddha does encourage a openness and expansion and inclusiveness of our mindfulness, the whole body, all of the sense doors, the emotions, and the thoughts are all happening in the present, here, now. Perhaps the most loving thing that we can do is let go of needing this moment to be any different than it is. Radical acceptance of our minds, of our hearts, of our bodies. And in this letting go, we come to understand the impermanent nature of the thoughts, of the sensations, the emotions, arising and passing, appearing, sustaining, and dissolving. as we pay closer and closer attention, awareness reveals that some of our experiences are unpleasant. The body becomes uncomfortable, or uncomfortable thoughts or emotions come. The loving awareness is then called to respond with mercy and compassion. The loving relationship to pain is learning to care about it, non-clinging, caring. When the awareness is present with pleasant, maybe there's pleasant sensations in the body or in the heart or mind. The loving relationship to that which is pleasant is to appreciate it, enjoy it, without clinging, non-attached, non-clinging. Appreciation. You can continue this open, accepting present time awareness, or you could shift to the practice of loving kindness for the last couple minutes. Loving kindness is the intentional directing of the heart and mind for ease. Starting with yourself, may I be at ease just as I am. May I be at ease in this body, with this mind and all of its bad habits, self-centeredness. I'm extending this wish to each other, the people in the room, in the breakout rooms, in the Sangha, all of us meditating together, extending the wish for ease and well-being, freedom from suffering, this loving wish, goodwill to each other. May you be at ease. And then expanding in all directions, the east and west and north and south, above and below, until you cover this whole planet, all of the continents, all of the oceans, mountains. With this intention to meet all living beings with love, with kindness, with goodwill. May all beings be at ease. May all beings find the willingness to do what needs to be done in their circumstances, in their life, to meet their pain with compassion, to meet other people's pain with compassion, to meet the pleasures, the joys of existence with non-clinging. May all beings be at ease as this beautiful, loving wish, but with the wisdom, the understanding. All beings are responsible for their own happiness. This core understanding that happiness, unhappiness, ease or uneasiness is all in how we respond, how we relate to our pain, to our pleasure, to our minds. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be free from suffering. Seems to be the case that due to survival instincts, evolutionary biology of the species, that we're just born into a mind body that clings, that craves. And I find that understanding that and framing it that way is helpful. It takes all of the blame, hopefully blame and shame, and out of like, well, why am I so attached? Why am I not so good at just being loving and non-attached? And just that sort of like, it's just the system that you're born into, a system that has this instinctual drive to cling. It's not your fault. It's not our fault. Clinging is, it's the second noble truth. You know, when the Buddha figured it out and got free from clinging and aversion, And he said, okay, how am I going to teach this? Like, first he normalized the suffering, first noble truth. Suffering is part of the package. If you take birth, you're going to have some suffering. And then the kind of why? What's the cause? It's tanha is the word he used. Bhava is another word that he used a lot. Bhava is clinging. Tanha is craving, thirst. And then it's just normal. There's no blame. There's no judgment. There's no, you know, this sort of like, hey, what's your experience between clinging and loving? And Judy's sort of half joke of like, same thing. You know, how often we just, even in when we fall in love, there's so much attachment. When we love, that clinging is just, it's the near enemy. It's the flip side of the coin, however you want to. It's just we're wired to cling. One of the reasons why the Buddha said this path goes against the stream, the Pali word was patiso tagami, against the current or against the stream. To wake up is to go against, you know, the stream that's normal to cling. That's the stream. Greed, hatred, delusion, clinging, craving, self-centeredness. Normal. Status quo. Ordinary. Universal. Non-clinging. It's a radical act. Is a long-term process of retraining our minds, rewiring our hearts and our nervous systems and our to understand the truth of impermanence, you know, as I said in the meditation instructions. I mean, maybe it's a stupid question, but probably some of us have it, is like, well, what's the problem with clinging? And I guess clinging wouldn't be a problem if everything wasn't impermanent. But so I'm not sure if it's the attachment tendency, the clinging that's the culprit, or it's impermanence that's the culprit, that's the cause. Because, you know, we all cling, you know, we all get attached, we all cling, we all crave, we all, it's just part of what the human mind does. And I guess it wouldn't be a problem if things weren't impermanent, but because everything, everyone, every situation, every is transient, is impermanent, is a process of change. Every time we cling, how many things did you cling to today? And clinging can be anywhere from, I don't know, I guess it is important to make a distinction between kind of clinging and craving and desire. You know that difference where like desire, like if you reflect on your day, maybe there were some things that happened in your experience today that you would have liked to have not happened. You would have, or some things that you desired that didn't happen. But desire feels like that take it or leave it. I want it, but I don't need it. I'm not going to suffer if I don't get what I want, desire. And clinging, craving feels like, no, it has to be the way I want it to be in order to find, for my nervous system to relax, to find any sense of ease, I have to get what I want. You need to be the way I want you to be. The world needs to be the way I want it to be. And my mind needs to be the way, you know, I need to be different than I am in some way. There's a need in the clinging and the craving rather than a want. And I do feel like this is an important distinction. Sometimes Buddhism gets translated. Even some of the teachers that I like sometimes translate that desire's the problem. And, you know, I don't like it that because I don't quite understand. Maybe it's just that I don't believe that we could actually be desireless. I don't feel like wanting is the problem. It's that tanha, craving and clinging, feel like much more extreme. It's that, you know, wanting isn't, I don't want this to be happening, but I'm not going to be resisting it or clinging to it, needing it to be different. Of course we don't want pain. Of course we don't want all of the ignorance and corruption and injustice on this planet. Of course there's a healthy, loving, compassionate desire for it not to be this way. But there's also a wisdom that accepts this is the way it is. I'm doing my best to respond appropriately with wisdom, with compassion. I don't know if it was last week or regularly in my practice the last few years, I've been really trying to sit with, I think I spent so many years trying to let go. I saw how attached I am, I was. And I just felt like, and I heard the simple teachings, let go. And that simple teaching that I love to give, which says, it's from Ajahn Chah. My teacher's teacher, Ajahn Chah, was a Thai forest monk, meditation master. And this simple teaching that says, he said something like, if you let go a little bit of non-attachment, non-clinging, if you let go a little bit, you'll have a little bit of happiness in your life. And if you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of sense of well-being, of non, you know, no clinging, no less and less suffering. And he said, and when we let go, non-clinging, complete surrender and acceptance of the impermanent nature of things, if you let go absolutely, he said something like, you will have, you know, absolute happiness, freedom, liberation. He said, you'll know the happiness of the Buddha, what it is to be awake, what it is to be free from suffering. And then there's an image that he used where he said, and your heart, your mind will become still like a forest pool, like a still forest pool. And that I probably heard that image 30 something years ago. And I thought, okay, let go, let go, let go, let go. And one of my teachers that inspires me, Ajahn Chah's first Western student, Ajahn Sumedho, he said, and for years, his whole meditation practice is he would just sit here and as a mantra say, let go, let go, let go, let go. And he said he did 2 or 3 years of just repeating let go over and over and over because he saw the clinging is causing suffering. Letting go will end suffering. The last part of that still forest pool image that I think is really important when we think about letting go and all of our ideas about stillness, about what that will be like, what that will feel like, what our is he adds to the image. He says, your heart, your mind will become like a still forest pool. And he says, all kinds of strange and wonderful animals will come to drink from the stillness. And I feel like the strange and wonderful animals piece is really important for us to remember. And that this idea of an empty mind and a still mind that's free from thought, my sense is the strange and wonderful animals are thoughts and emotions. But that when there's that non-attached loving awareness that we can embody and experience, we start to see the thoughts and emotions as just strange and wonderful animals coming to drink from the stillness. And that the stillness itself, the awareness itself, is unperturbed by even afflictive emotions. Oh, anger, you know, or the, you know, lions and tigers and bears and whatever it is that come through the mind. There's an awareness that is unmoved, unperturbed. Still stillness. Stillness isn't the absence of thought, absence of sensation, absence of emotion. It's the absence of trying to control them or be identified with them as who we are. It's the arising. It's the understanding. They're all coming through this great spacious awareness that is not clinging and is not identified with the mind as self, as who we are. What I was starting to say was, I've been in my own practice and life after spending so many years, probably decades, in this kind of, I need to let go. Nothing's worth clinging to. There's another teaching that has been on heavy rotation, a short saying, teaching in one of the suttas, where the Buddha says something like, there is nothing as you meditate and you investigate your heart, your mind, your body. There's nothing worth clinging to in here as I or me or mine. Try to find it. What are you clinging to? What are we protecting? What are we defending? What are we, that ego self mind that needs to be right, that needs to be appreciated, that needs to be whatever it is, clinging to I, me, mine. Maybe I talked about this a little bit last week, but where's that place? And I don't know the answer to this, but it's like a lot of Dharma practice. It's the question maybe that's more important than the answer and the investigation and the process, which is, where's that line between non-attachment and becoming irresponsible? Reflecting on this a lot, not only in my own life, but in my my role as a parent, as a father. And where's that line between being non-attached and non-controlling and non, accepting, well, my kids have their own karma and they're responsible for their own, all of these understandings, but also that I'm a parent and gotta have some boundaries and I gotta have some structure and some, and how I probably lean towards irresponsible because I'm not attached enough sometimes or connected enough to the responsibility of that role of being like, no, you're 16. And you know how it is to be 16, where you know everything. And remembering like, okay, no, you're 16. Like you know everything, and I'm responsible, and I need to not go too far towards that let go and more towards container, connection. To something that I'm reflecting on and sitting with a lot. And sometimes in these teachings where it's like, well, let go of everything, let go absolutely. But, like you can't let go of some of your responsibilities and your ethics and your, roles. And like, well, in this role, actually, I need to, maybe it's not clinging, but it's boundaries and it's communication and it's consequence. And it's all of those things, with still understanding that our children have their own karma and not getting too into the sort of like, I can control you or anybody, our partners. Some of you are parents and you can relate to that role, but maybe you're not a parent and you can relate to that experience of just like in your relationship of like, I want you to be different than you. I want you to feel different than you are. I want you to behave different than you are. And that clinging to another person being different than they are. And maybe this is that segue into the second, before class, I asked three people for topics. And they said consciousness or awareness and love and attachment. So I'm sort of trying to weave awareness, consciousness, and attachment, non-attachment into the topic tonight. And that reflection for ourselves of what's the difference between when I'm feeling loving, what's the experience of love? And I even just naturally for me, I do this sort of is an outflow. Love feels like an outflow. like a generosity, like a giving, like I care about you. I want to give to you. I want to, love feels like that to me. But clinging doesn't feel like that. Clinging feels like something else, right? It feels like I need this situation to be the way I want it to be. I need you to be the way I want you to be. I need myself to be, you know, perfect or the way I, you know, think I should be. I feel like love has my experience, a strong desire for the other person's happiness, especially when we're talking about romantic love, but not only romantic love, also friendly love, kind of doesn't have to be sexual or romantic, but like when you know, you love your friends or you love your children or you love your, that desire of like, I wish for your happiness. And it's easy to wish for your happiness. In romantic love, often, almost always for us feels like, but I need something in return. I need you to also, I'm attached not only to your happiness, but to you making me happy too. And maybe you have come to that place in relationships sometimes, that loving place that says, I want you to be happy with or without me. I love you and I want what, if you choose me, I'm stoked. I choose you. And if you choose me, great. But if you don't, you know, and if that's not what's mutually the right thing for us, you like, I want you to go be happy. I love you. I don't want you to stay with me if that's not what's right for your choice. And that non-attached attitude about love, like, I don't need you to stay with me. And that understanding of, I'll be okay. You'll be okay. And only, you know, in romantic love, only if it's mutually right, we continue day after day to choose each other. Rather than, you know, so many people suffer so much around like, well, they left me. And I've had this experience. And I've had this, honestly, I've had this experience more in the end of friendships more than in the end of romantic relationships, where it's like, wait, I wanted these friends to stay and they left, and seeing that clinging in those friendships, and those feelings of loss and then trying to remember, oh, if that's what's right for you, I want you to be happy. I don't need it to be about me getting my needs met. You know, like if that's not mutually right for both of us, then it's not right for either of us, kind of loving attitude. But it's so counter to our, you know, we do seem wired for attachment and for clinging. And so even though the Dharma says let go and wish for happiness for others and whatever's right for them, whether it includes you or doesn't include you, it's a pretty radical proposal. And of course, you know, it's tricky to talk about love, romantic love, and sexuality in a Buddhist context, because we're following this path of the guy who said, like, you know what, sex is pretty much suffering. And if you really, really don't want to suffer, celibacy is a really good idea, right? Like, it's actually quite, it's easier to not suffer and not cling when you're not engaged in romantic relationships, is a core perspective in Buddhism. It's possible to not cling in romantic relationships, but it's really hard to not do that. And I think it's wise for us all of us who are choosing to be engaged in loving, intimate, romantic relationships, to take full responsibility for the suffering we will experience in those, in that choice, rather than feeling like a victim or feeling like, you know, an unrealistic expectation. You ever go, you know, especially if you've been practicing Buddhism for a while, you're like, I'm going to go into this one with loving non-attachment. Good luck. Maybe, and maybe I think I've seen, and I think all of us will see over the years, like you build some skill in being less clinging, less needy, less taking things personal, less, you know, it loosens over the years of practice. But the idea that we're going to be able to enter into a intimate relationship without any suffering is probably unrealistic until we're really quite far into advanced levels of enlightenment. Because of the preference for the pleasant and the aversion to the unpleasant and the self-centered nature of our human mind and body. In the Buddha's teachings, when asked, you know, to explain what's happening here, there's a list where he kind of dismantles our experience, and this comes in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and maybe it's the fifth list that's offered on the fourth foundation, and he talks about the skandhas, the five. Some skanda translates as something like a pile or a heap, piles of experience, heaps of experience. And he said, you know, if you break down, if upon investigation, if you really see clearly what's happening in this human condition, there is a body, right? There's physical form. There's this body experiences feeling tone, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. There's the part of the mind that perceives the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling tone. There's the part of the mind that remembers, remembers the past and has all of that sort of, you know, how much of our self, our personality, our self view is all based on accumulated data, memory. I'm like this because I've had all of these experiences that I remember. And the fifth is that there's consciousness that, you know, is awareness, is consciousness that is that which, you know, perceives and remembers and feels the feeling tone and knows the body. And that all five of these are not self, are not who we are. They're all impermanent. They're all just part of this process. And when these five things come together, when there's a body with feeling tone and memory and perception and consciousness, there's that feeling of I, me, mine. The self is formed. A couple weeks ago, I was going off on the rainbow analogies. It's the same thing. Like, you know, like how does a rainbow, you know, you know a rainbow is created by light, moisture, I don't know, something to reflect off earth, you know, some surface. I mean, it's only three things to create a rainbow. I'm not sure. But so the self is the same thing. If you have memory, you will have the feeling of I am. If you have a body and a mind and consciousness, perception, it will create this illusion of this rainbow me. I am. I think, and that instinctual tendency to take everything personal, the ego self, the I, me, mine. Awareness, in the Buddhist teachings, is different than consciousness. Although I probably, and many of us would probably use consciousness and awareness interchangeably. Dennis and I started to talk about this a little bit before class. The Buddha said, taught, explained, that there's something called citta in this process that's unfolding here. And it is the citta that what could be translated. I often historically have translated as the heart and mind, heart mind. But as I, you know, kind of pay more attention to what some of my teachers are and then investigate that, and this last retreat that I was on, there was a lot of teachings on citta and this investigation of what that is. And Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro and these Buddhist monks that I study with are translating it these days as loving awareness, that the citta is the loving awareness that we experience, and that our memories are, you know, arising and passing in loving awareness, and our body sensations are known by a loving awareness, and even consciousness is within the loving awareness, and that their awareness can be aware of consciousness, and aware of the memories, and aware of the perceptions, and aware of the, and that the loving awareness, the citta, is not self, is not personal, and is not, and this is where it fucked me up when I asked the wrong question. It's not dependent on the body. Everything else is kind of a little bit rationally makes sense of when you take birth, you have a survival instinct and you have a you know, craving and aversion, and you have the memories and the perceptions. But the citta is nature, is dharma, is something that's beyond the body. It's something that... you know, maybe it's what some people might talk about as like universal consciousness. It's not personal, but it is in our experience, the loving awareness that's much bigger than self, much bigger than this lifetime's memories or perceptions or views or opinions or conditioning. I'm not sure exactly what the context was, but I remember on this recent retreat I was with Ajahn Amaro on, he was using something about citta and the Hindu teaching of that our true nature is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat is consciousness, consciousness being in bliss. Sat Chit Ananda. And that citta is that awareness, and that Ananda is bliss or love. And that there's very much a connection here between what the traditional Vedic Indian Hindu teaching was. And the shift is Sat Chit Ananda is, I think there's saying that's actually who you are. And the Buddha is saying, like, I don't even cling to that as an identity. Don't even cling to bliss and consciousness as who you are. See that it's all just an unfolding process, that there's nothing worth clinging to as I or me or mind, even awareness, even bliss, even consciousness. If you get too attached to that as your identity, you will also be taking a wrong turn. Some way or another. So we have a few minutes left for questions, comments, clarifications, discussion. Judy, go ahead.
So thank you for your talk. So what I've gotten out of it, to me, love is more like a namaste. So like what I see, the light I see in you is what I see in myself. And that I love you for that. And I love everybody else because we are all alike. Then in regards to being in a relationship, I think because I'm new in one, that I have a craving. Mm-hmm. But as long as I understand that because there is really no time frame, but as long as I understand within that time frame, I could have the attachment, because eventually it's going to be over. And to accept that when that time is that it's over and be okay with that. So I think that's what I got out of that.
You've seen me and Dennis was pointing out earlier that there's that in relationships and in all of our interpersonal connections, not just romantic relationships, but the ideal is connection. And then when impermanence, it happens, it's not so painful when that disconnection happens. It's not so devastating when we're just connected and then that that connection ends or changes in whatever way. But when we're clinging and that connection ends, the person dies or, you know, the relationship ends or whatever it is, the friendship ends, when we've been holding on like this. And so then it's so painful and we're digging our nails in when impermanence happens. And that often there's an overcorrection, where, and we hear Buddhist teachings that there's this overcorrection where we go to detachment, be like, well, that fucking hurt. I'm not going to do that again. No more clinging, you know, and then we try to sort of, you know, get in this like avoidance of connection because we're afraid we'll cling. And it's a healthy and realistic fear. We will cling. But I feel like in relationship, it's a dance, and it's a dance of clinging, connection, detaching, coming back together, connecting, clinging, maybe not so much detachment, just kind of being like, oh, okay, let's this corrective from clinging to connection, clinging to connection. And that the ideal is non-attached, embrace. That's not, taking hostages. That's, you know, it's a connected, it's a hug, and it's not shackles. Yeah. But it's not avoidance. Sometimes we hear of non-attachment and we think like, oh, I've got to be separate from it rather than connected to it. Connected non-clinging. Any other thoughts before we end tonight? Anything at home, you can just raise your hand in the reactions tab.
I heard a quote once. I don't remember why, but it says, everything I've ever let go of in my life has claw marks on it.
Claw marks. Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Could you guys hear it at home? Everything I've ever let go of in my life has claw marks on it. Pointing to that, like we're not very good at letting go. That often there's a tendency. And where I started, I want to come back to where I started, which like, not your fault. And even when you learn Buddhist non-attachment practice and mindfulness and you read the book and you know, like, oh, everything's impermanent. I should stop clinging. Easier said than done. We're, you know, like it's not just a decision we can make. It's a long-term skill that we build over the years and decades of non-attachment training. And that kind of overcorrection of like, oh, actually now I'm too non-attached. I've become irresponsible. I need to reconnect and not be detached and be connected presence. And, you know, it's a process, a long-term process. You know, maybe it's not, you know, for the monks and the nuns, maybe they, you know, they can really kind of do that complete non-attachment. But for those of us in parenting roles and in romantic relationships and in, you know, communities that, you know, there's some necessity of like, actually, I can't be detached. I have to stay connected.
Relate that to Al-Anon talk for a moment.
Go ahead. I don't know if I can, but do you have an idea about it?
No, I'm really struggling with a sibling, and you know, I understand like the three C's of Al-Anon. I mean, created, I can't control it.
Kira the third, yeah.
But the love of the sibling,
yeah,
is like, I'm really attached to her success in life, but it's that we can't get there, and I don't know what the right attachment is, and yet if I let go too much, I'm afraid for what will happen. So I'm really struggling with this, and through a sibling love,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And where to let go, and where to, and in the family, is it clinging? Because it's such a family disease, mm-hmm. right? That it's, did we learn that connection?
Mm-hmm. It's the right question. I don't know if everybody can. Could you hear at home for the most part? No. It's the right question of like, where is the, she was asking about in family with a sibling, the sort of Al-Anon codependency enabling, where's the line between letting go and being responsible, caring, loving sister or sibling or, it's the right question. I don't have the answer. And I don't know if you know, but my sister died just a couple weeks ago from addiction. When I look back on my relationship with her, I was probably a little detached. You know, a long time ago, I sort of detached with love and we stayed in contact, but I didn't, you know, really know how to show up for somebody that was in and out of active addiction. And I probably went a little farther that way. And then of course, when they do die, then there's all of that sort of the mind that says like, fuck, maybe I could have helped.
Mm-hmm. Love, but
yeah,
dude, that's hard.
Yeah,
it's so hard.
Yeah, I think my own tendency, because my life is about service to recovery people, is like, if you want help, I'm here. And for sure, my sister knew, like, I'm here. If she wanted help, she would have, you know, the door was open. We were in contact, but I wasn't clingy. I wasn't controlly, and I wasn't preachy. But then, of course, the mind says, like, fuck, maybe I should have preached a little bit more. If I would have known she was on, you know, death's door, I would have tried to do an intervention. But I was disconnected so much that I didn't know that that's what was happening, you know, because our, you know, biannual phone calls weren't, I wasn't connected to how, you know, danger, how much danger she was in. Not that interventions always work, but still that willingness to. So it's the right question. I certainly don't have the answer, but it's something that we all have to sit with. And in the Buddha's teachings, it's that balance between compassion and love and care and equanimity. And you know, we've had this conversation before, equanimity of, and I put it in the meditation instructions tonight, all beings, happiness or unhappiness depends on their relationship to what's happening, and certainly not our wishes for them. No matter how much we love our siblings, we can't make them become wise or sober or anything else. They have to do that. But the compassionate, loving thing to do is to, on some level, you know, stay somewhat connected. It's tricky because then, you know, the other side of that irresponsible, you know, there's the irresponsible non-attachment, and then there's the clinging love that has an unrealistic expectation that we can save somebody, or we begin enabling people because, well, I love you and you're my friend or my family or my whomever it is, and my support in your life is actually enabling you to stay stuck in some way, where actually what you really need is a strong fucking boundary. But when we put those strong boundaries up and then they die, it's fucking heartbreaking because you kind of feel like, fuck, maybe I shouldn't have had such strong boundaries. Not that it would have worked the other way, but of course the mind wants to figure it out. Yeah. Probably enough for tonight. A few announcements. 10-day silent retreat. You're all invited. here in Los Angeles, like at end of September, early October. We've got 9 nights, 10 days, silence, sitting and walking meditation. This is the best way to really deepen your practice and your awareness and your, to have that long-term experience of sitting with your mind and dealing with your body and being in silence, noble silence. You get Dharma talks every day. You get instructions in Dharma, you know, kind of meditation instructions a couple times a day. A lot of you've done it. Come back. Some of you haven't done it. Even if you've never done a retreat before, you can jump into a 10-day. It's okay. I started doing 10-day retreats when I was like 19 years old and I was a mess. So you'll survive it. You'll be fine. Trying to get a day long on the books for a day of sitting and walking. Sebastian and I are going to try to get that done, scheduled this week. I think sometime mid-August, a month or so, we'll do a day of practice if people want to. And class is done by donation. Against the Stream is a nonprofit, totally supported by your voluntary contributions. We have overhead, thousands of dollars a month that we need to raise. Be as generous, you know, just to pay rent and support, you know, Sebastian as the kind of manager of the center and as of the social media, and to support me as a teacher. So give as much as you can, as much as you want to. Suggested donation for drop-in is like $25, like you'd pay for a yoga class or something. But if you can give more, please give more. And also, if you can't afford a $25 donation, you're welcome to be here. It's intentionally that we don't exclude anybody for lack of ability to donate. But practice generosity is the encouragement. Lastly, for my own livelihood, I am a counselor. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology. I've had a private practice for 20 years. I go in and out of taking clients and focus depending on how much writing I'm doing or administrative stuff I'm doing for the nonprofits. But right now I have a few openings for counseling clients. So if anybody would like to meet with me one-on-one, whether you're, you know, virtual and you want to do Zoom sessions, I prefer in person, but if you're, you know, somewhere else in the world and you'd like to do some Zoom sessions, we could do that. Just reach out to me. You can talk, if you're here in person, you can talk to me. I'll give you my number. If you're online and you'd like to do some counseling sessions, and whether that's for, you know, psychological recovery stuff or it's guidance in the Buddhist path, if you'd like to meet with me, I'm open to meeting with you. I do charge for it, and we can talk about that if you're interested. You could get to anybody at home, can all of the emails through the Against the Stream website come to me. So you could reach out that way, and we could schedule something. I think that's it. Did I forget anything, Sebastian? Got it.
Good job, Sebastian.
Many goodness that comes from our practice and discussion of the Buddha Dharma be shared with each other and outwards in all directions. Many merit that comes from this lead to a positive change on this planet. Good seeing everybody. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.